This is Peace and Social Justice on your radio station, KZFR 90.1, Chico listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And I'm your third Friday host, Pastor Jesse Kearns. And I've got an interesting show lined up here. I'm not sure if there's any particular theme to it, but I get to talk to some leaders kind of on a walkabout that I took. I get to talk to the new director at Stonewall Alliance, and I have something from the Old Faith and Common Ground archives. So hope that you'll be able to stay with us throughout the show today. We're going to get started with our first segment.
Is your car frozen? Let it go. Those expensive car repairs that once controlled you, well, they can't get to you at all once you've donated it to KZFR. It's easy, and KZFR takes care of everything at no cost to you. Whether it's running or not, your car, truck, and even boat has the potential to bring significant funds to support your favorite programs. Here's how to give. Go to KZFR.org to complete our online donation form, or call 888-593-7288. That's 888-593-7288.
I am well into my 13th year of living here in beautiful Chico, California. I moved here in December of 2007. I spent the previous 9 years in Virginia working as a regional minister or an associate regional minister. I didn't oversee one particular congregation. I had 170 congregations that were under the regional office's care. I started missing home. I grew up here on the West Coast, specifically in Oregon, born in Arizona, raised outside of Eugene, Oregon. And it had been a while since we had been back living in this side of the Rockies. Of course, my parents and my wife's parents were wondering when they'd be able to get to see the grandkids more often. So that's when Mary and I made the choice of moving here to the West Coast again. And where we found work was right here in beautiful Chico, California. There were a few things about Chico that I had never experienced before. When we moved, again, it was December 2007. January and February of 2008 were especially rainy. I believe we had a storm that produced the kind of winds that took a tree out in our backyard and bent our chain link fence where a wild rose was growing. So we weren't too sure what to make of that. We were used to being on the East Coast in Virginia where we would get the tail end of a hurricane every now and then. But we just automatically thought, well, this is what winters are like here in Chico. So once we got through the rainy season, it was probably about May when the rains stopped, we were able to enjoy Lake Oroville at its fullest. I had seen Shasta Lake a few times in my childhood on vacations where it was full, but most of the time Shasta Lake was not full, even growing up as a kid. Chico was an amazing place. I had never seen anything like Bidwell Park. I was impressed with the natural swimming pool at 1 mile. I was thoroughly impressed, as were my kids, at Caper Acres. There were miles and miles of bicycle trails. And again, I grew up near Eugene, Oregon, so I knew what a bicycle-friendly town was. And Chico seemed to be even more bike-friendly than Eugene, Oregon. It didn't take me long to realize that we didn't have rainy seasons like the winter of 2008 very often. In fact, I had never lived anywhere that it would go months without raining. That was foreign to me, even coming from Oregon to Virginia. Virginia was one of those places where you didn't dare hang your laundry out anywhere past 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because just about every day in the summer, there would be a little thunderstorm that would come through sometime after three, between 3 and 7 in the evening, and just kind of wet everything down. We'd never had a sprinkler in our yard, even during dry seasons in Virginia. So that was a big shock, having such a dry climate. But I've got to tell you, I can take 100 degrees in the dry climate here better than I could take 83 degrees in a humid place like Virginia. The people in Chico were especially friendly. The downtown area was right out of an old movie. It looked like the town square in Back to the Future almost. We love Chico, and we're ready to settle in for the long haul. And we still love Chico. Our church has always been involved in food ministry at the Jesus Center. We would occasionally go to, I believe it was every fifth Sunday, and there's only 4 fifth Sundays in a year, we would prepare breakfast and have some musical offerings that we would give to the Jesus Center on Sunday mornings. We have a congregation that are dedicated to helping people who are often marginalized, including folks without a roof. So this was part of our outreach ministry and has always been a part of our outreach ministry, even before I came here. One of the things that I recognized right away when I moved here was how expensive housing was. I was very thankful that the First Christian Church in Chico had a parsonage for us to live in, because what we sold our 4-bedroom, 2-bath, split-level house on 3/4 of an acre of wooded property in Lynchburg, Virginia, wouldn't get us very much here at all. In fact, it would require twice as much to find a compatible house to what we had in Virginia. But that's just West Coast prices for you. As the years went by, as we lived here in Chico, we recognized that there was some housing issues here, especially the availability of affordable housing. Naturally, in a college town, housing is going to be a little bit more than a non-college town. But even with that, it seemed that there were enough options and avenues for people who wanted to have housing to have housing. As time went on, we recognized that the housing problem turned into a housing crisis. 2017 was a rough year because that was the year that the Oroville Dam emergency happened. And then, of course, in 2018 is when the campfire happened. But even before the campfire, Chico City Council declared a housing crisis. There was not enough affordable housing here in Chico. And that housing crisis quickly turned into a housing emergency when almost 20,000 people were displaced by the campfire, many of who came here to Chico to find emergency shelter. I think for the first few months after the fire itself, Chico had open hearts, open minds, and open doors as far as their willingness to help other people, especially those who didn't have shelter. Our church opened its doors to some folks who were displaced. We had we are a Red Cross emergency shelter. And so just a few weeks after the fire, we started having some flooding rains here in Chico. So we opened up our fellowship hall for an emergency shelter for as long as the rains were coming down as hard as they were. We were also nesting a church in our denomination from Paradise. They came down here and worshiped in the side of our church facilities that was the fellowship hall. We still had the sanctuary where we typically worshiped, and the fellowship hall became the place where our sister church was worshiping. we provided some space on one of our lots for a trailer so that an unhoused family could stay there until they could find other housing. It became very clear that Chico could not handle the number of displaced people who were here on top of our normal population that was unsheltered. Now we had many, many more who could not find housing. To complicate matters even more, a lot of property owners decided that they were going to take advantage of the need for housing. And so they were either raising rents on their rental property or they were selling their houses and moving out of Chico. It became difficult for some of our church members to continue to live here in Chico because of the price of housing, especially for rentals. So we lost some. We've had folks move to Oregon, to Arizona, to Virginia, to Texas. We lost a good number of people from our congregation just because they could no longer afford housing here in Chico. And you know, if it was hard for those folks, it would be especially hard for the poorest of the poor here in Chico. Not only did we have displaced people who were living in camps, campgrounds, motorhomes, old motorhomes and recreational vehicles, and in parks, we had folks who were housed only weeks before who had not lost their house, unable to afford to live in their current living situation. We have lived in this housing emergency ever since. So think about that. It's 2018, and now it is 2021. There are plenty of campfire survivors who are still not housed and are still having to rely on local agencies to provide some of their basic needs. It was clear that we had a big problem, but it was also clear that we did not have many solutions. The pandemic certainly hasn't helped either. Fortunately, a number of local agencies have been able to provide some help for our unsheltered. Safe Space was no longer able to operate as they normally operated, but fortunately, Project Room Key came in and we had an alternative. But it was clear that patience was running out for a lot of our citizens here in Chico. Fortunately, the Ninth Circuit Court ruling allows homeless persons to sleep on public property in the absence of adequate alternatives to housing. In other words, they cannot be punished for sleeping outside on public property. But in the last few months, the city has spent a lot of time and energy trying to be strategic in getting around rather than complying with this Ninth Circuit ruling. They've pushed people out further and further towards the edges of the town with, in some cases, the stated intention of making them so miserable that maybe they'll leave or come back to, you know, go back to where they came from, wherever that is. Despite the fact that every study shows that the majority of people on our streets are from the area and really have no connections to other places and have no places to go. So for the last few months, we have seen people evicted from Bidwell Park near 1 mile. We've seen them evicted from Windchime. We have seen them evicted from under the bridges of Highway 99. And finally, on April 8th, 72-hour eviction notices were given to campers at Comanche Creek, one of the last campgrounds still standing. But on Sunday, April 11th, a federal judge issued a restraining order that put an immediate halt to all evictions that the city of Chico might issue for illegal encampment on public property. So I decided this week to take a walkabout. First place that I went to was Comanche Creek Campground because I went there on Monday morning fully expecting there to be evictions, and I noticed that there was a call for folks to come down and maybe help some of the campers move their stuff away. This happened at some of the other eviction sites too, so this was the last, it seemed like it was the last campground in Chico, and I went there fully expecting there to be evictions, but I discovered that's when the 72-hour restraining order had been issued. So part one of my walkabout is at Comanche Creek. I spoke to some folks, local homeless advocates, housing advocates, just trying to figure out what was going on and what the feeling is among the people who are living there and those who are trying to provide some help and some hope, but are finding themselves running into a lot of roadblocks. And then the second part of my walkabout was near the downtown plaza. Right now the plaza is closed and roped off, but there is a fountain in front of City Hall where a new outreach has cropped up. And this is in response to the Jesus Center no longer providing meals, serving breakfast. This group is now serving breakfast, coffee, donuts, muffins, and bananas to folks who need it. I had the pleasure of interviewing Cicery Sherry, who is a local human rights activist, about how this outreach started and how she feels about some of the things that are going on in town. So come along with me for this little walkabout. We'll start out at Comanche Creek and we will end near the fountain at City Hall.
But first, let's give some shout outs to our underwriters. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. The Wildflower returns this year on April 24th with a slightly different twist. A two-week-long extravaganza with three options to participate. Special edition merchandise, and virtual interaction along the way. To join the Wildflower Adventure, visit wildflowercentury.org and on Facebook. Again, this is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR.
So Gail Hill is the first person I'm talking to this morning. She is the pastor of First Baptist Church and is also on the board of Safe Space. So Gail, tell me what I'm seeing here.
Well, we have been hearing about what was going to happen this morning at Comanche Creek, where our unsheltered neighbors were going to be ousted out. And so we came here to form a prayer circle around to be able to pray and discern what would be the best practical solutions for our unsheltered guests. And so that's why we're here this morning, not only to pray, but also spend time talking with the people here and finding out their stories, finding out how we can better help to house them or find the types of resources that they need.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, there we go. Could you state your name, please?
Maria Ross Walcott.
Maria, tell me about 40 grandmothers.
Okay, we're a fairly new group of grandmothers. And our tagline that we've generated is this: 40 grandmothers rise in solidarity, silence, and prayer for the benefit of our thriving and resilient communities.
Okay. So we're down here at Comanche Creek on a day where there were supposed to be evictions, where the city was supposed to be evicting the campers down here. And there's been a stay issued by a judge here in California
for at least 72 hours. And yet here you are this morning, even though 72 hours has yet to expire. What are you doing here this morning?
Well, I'm showing up this morning to stand up for the unhoused, to acknowledge the humanity of each and every one of these campers, and to just take some time out of my day and my life to, you know, put into action that conviction that we are all in this together.
So I'm talking to Patrick Newman, who is a local advocate for homeless rights. What are you doing here today, Pat?
Well, so for 8 years, my focus has been human rights in the public space. And so there's a bunch of different dimensions to that. It has to do with access to toilets, criminalization laws, the right to rest, everything that affects people's experience of being in the public space with their interfaces with the community and with law enforcement and all that. So there's a wide spectrum of opinion on how we should respond to this kind of poverty.
Right.
My position on how we should respond is we should open up our commons and our public spaces and allow people to use them, given that they've been driven into a kind of poverty that involves shelter deprivation.
Right.
So whether or not these people have a right to be here and set up a tent is a right to rest issue. It falls under that category, and that's under the umbrella of what Chico Friends on the Street is focused on. So I've been vocally supportive of leaving all of these tent camps in place, every single one of them. We did 12 days on the triangle down there, trying to get enough critical mass to at least slow down, obstruct the whole process of removing that tent camp. It's kind of been an ongoing, interesting evolution of community awareness. And I think what's happening with this is that you have a certain kind of dramatic moment where people are losing their tents, and I think the awareness of that, or there's a growing awareness of the fact that these people are experiencing these kinds of human rights violations because you have something very visible happening. Most of the time, pre-COVID, there was no shelter in place allowed, and so you had this milling of people all the time, constantly being rousted, constantly being displaced. That was the norm in Chico. That's one of the ways we punish people that are on the streets. So this has created an anomaly and something different and visible. So it's a moment, and trying to get support for these camps back last summer when we knew this was coming, the uptake and traction on that was difficult to get. Once it starts to happen, I think people, it's just more tangible. So anyway, these are all, you know, human rights in the public space issues that swirl around these tent camps. So yeah, I don't know. The 12 days on the triangle was the first attempt to try to get critical mass. And now I see another upswelling of interest with this camp. So you know, with the TRO in place, temporary restraining order in place, that gives us some breathing room. And this morning, what you were saying about people showing up here, they were showing up anticipating a sweep, anticipating the cops coming in and just, you know, beginning that process we've seen over and over again. And it's not happening, and that's kind of a wonderful thing to celebrate on one level, because it's not happening. And the other one is we have some litigation for justice in Chico, and that's really, really, really important to the story. It changes the story, and that's important. Win or lose, it changes the story.
So I'm talking with Charles Wathoon, who is a local homeless advocate, and he is here at Comanche Creek this morning with his trailer. And well, we're pretty happy about the 72-hour injunction here, but here we are at Comanche Creek. What are you doing here today, Charles?
Thank you, Jesse. Good seeing you. Happy to be here. North State Shelter Team and members of the faith community have showed up here this morning, and we agreed to make this a regular event. We're going to meet here every Sunday at 2:00 after Friends on the Street and get to know our neighbors, get to know the campers, and involve the campers in little cleanup activity every Sunday at 2 to make sure that the place stays neat and clean for the benefit of the whole community.
One of the things that I've been disturbed about is the amount of talk there is about folks who are at these camps being from out of town, and that they're somehow traveling far away to come here to take advantage of all the services that we have here in Chico. What is your response to that narrative?
It's ridiculous, really. If it were true, then people here would be going to where there are more services.
Yeah.
Chico is actually very lacking in services, as exemplified by one overflowing dumpster where there should be three, and three little porta potties where there should be six, and one wildcat campground where we need four sanctioned campgrounds. Other towns have organized programs. Eugene, Medford, Ashland is starting a downtown or urban campground. Marysville has the 14 Forward Tiny Home Village. Many of the surrounding towns have active programs for the homeless that Chico does not. And so we're here to show community support for our neighbors and help clean up and get to know the campers and demonstrate to the larger community that it is way more fun and rewarding to work with people instead of fight with people.
The next stop on my walkabout was to the downtown plaza, or I should say, the fountain in front of the city hall, where I spoke to Cicery Sherry, who is part of the Progressive Delegates Network. In fact, she is a representative for Assembly District Number 3. We talked about poverty solutions and a new outreach that she and some friends started there at the fountain.
So as I was doing some research on the PDN and some of the things that you've contributed to that organization, I noticed that poverty solutions and human rights seems to be at the top of your list for important things to deal with here in Chico.
Absolutely.
So what are you doing right here and now? This is what I'm seeing right now is I'm at the fountain, and I see coffee and muffins and bananas and some folks dropping by for breakfast.
This is the Chico Friends on the Street free breakfast program. We just started it up. It's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 a.m. We're starting out at City Hall by the Fish Fountain, but once the plaza's open back up, we're going to move over there.
Okay. So how long has this been going on?
Today is day number 2.
Oh, okay. Very good. So this is a brand new outreach. Okay, what prompted you to do this?
The Jesus Center closed, and we need to replace them. Average citizens, apparently. It's down to us. And so this is just the first step to that. I wish I could do it every day, but I can't do it every day. But it's just all about getting the necessary supplies out to people. We've got coercive deprivation going on. The city is trying to push our homeless residents out of town. And they're doing that by rousting them and also by depriving them of basic needs. The Jesus Center was the only soup kitchen we had in town that was no barrier. So we need to step up and replace that.
Yeah. So as far as I know, there is no other place or organization in town that is feeding folks because Jesus Center was the last one. What's your understanding? Other than you out here doing this, what do you know?
There are other citizens groups stepping up. Hunger Trolley is doing some work right now, and the DSA is also active in providing material and solidarity to the homeless.
Okay. So I guess one of the questions that I'm curious about is, why are you so committed to this? It takes time out of your day to gather all this food together and to set it all up. and provide this service. What drives you? What is your motivation for being involved in this?
I don't like to see people hungry. That's it.
That's pretty simple. Well, there's a lot of hungry people in Chico. I was just at Comanche Creek. They were going to start evicting people from Comanche Creek, but a judge issued an order to halt that. And as I went down there, there was quite a few concerned citizens who were willing to help, who were willing to clean up. And one of the big sentiments that was expressed down there is we as human beings cannot just stand back and watch other human beings be pushed around. How long have you been in Chico?
I've been in Chico since 2007.
So in your time in Chico since 2007, how have you seen the dynamics change in Chico as far as how homeless are treated?
Well, there's certainly over time a lot more homeless residents. A lot of people are living really close to the edge and the bottom falls out. And so we've just been seeing more and more of that on the street. And with the last city council, it seemed like they were given some respite to live and exist. But with this new city council, they're again violating their civil rights to exist in the public space.
So one of the things that concerns me is the big picture solution to poverty here in Chico, because clearly this is not a problem that's going away, and clearly pushing people out of town is not the solution. What do you think are some solutions to tackle poverty here in Chico?
Permanent affordable housing. That's number one. When you have more people than there is housing, then it's a mathematical certainty that people will be living on the streets. We need permanent income-based housing.
And what do you think is the biggest obstacle for having that taking place here in Chico?
Greed. Greed. Developers want to build houses for rich folks from the Bay Area to come and move here.
I know that at least since 2018, we've been under a shelter crisis, which then turned into a shelter emergency after the campfire, and only recently was that emergency lifted. How do you think that's going to impact the services that exist here in Chico and ultimately the people who are receiving those services?
So the city manager determined that the vote to rescind the shelter crisis pretty much doesn't matter. They would have to agendize it and, I believe, pass it through resolution. So as far as I know, funding is not impacted so far.
Well, Cicery, thank you for the good work that you do down here, and I appreciate taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Jesse.
So that was my Monday walkabout. Not much has changed. Cicery and her friends are still providing breakfast at the fountain by City Hall. There are still folks camped at Comanche Creek, and there still seems to be no solutions to our housing issues. I do have to wonder, though, if our biggest problem is not a housing crisis, but rather a moral crisis. This is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR. And this is FM 90.1 KZFR, Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And for our next segment, we are going to go back into the Faith and Common Ground archives for an interview with Kate McCarthy.
Joining me today is Kate McCarthy, Dean of Undergraduate Education and Professor of Comparative Religions at Chico State. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks.
We've been doing a lot of talking lately here at the station and at my church about how polarized our country is right now. And I see it in local politics. I, of course, see it in national politics. And I see it dealing with it even in my own local congregation. I remember if you look back in history, it's not like that we have never been through a time in our country where we've been polarized. In fact, if you look way back in history, you can see where people are mudslinging and such like that. But I know in my own lifetime, and even in the lifetime of some older folks in our congregation, I cannot remember when it has been polarized to the point where one political party actually thinks that the other is a threat to our country.
I think we are at a low point for a generation, but yeah. It is important to remember that we've been here before nationally and we have survived it. We just have to figure out how.
Okay. Well, that's why I want to talk to you today. Tell me about what you think is the most pressing issue when it comes to our polarization as a country.
Well, I want to start by saying I come at this as a person who thinks and talks about religion more than politics. Okay. I have no training as a political scientist. But over the past few years, I've been thinking a great deal about how what we know about how people with different religious orientations relate to each other, what that has to tell us about how people who are politically different
right.
relate to each other. And I think there are lessons to be learned from one for the other. What I think is most pressing is that we have dehumanized one another.
Mm.
We don't actually argue about policy much in my experience of this really polarized climate. We just sort of throw ideological labels at each other and thereby dismiss each other. And there's really not a great deal of engagement
right.
across those lines.
Yeah, and I see that too quite a bit. I don't want to say in my own congregation in that people are at each other's throats, but they don't want to talk about
right.
issues.
Right. We want to be polite
right.
because we're afraid, because we've seen in media and especially social media how ugly it gets, and
yeah.
who wants to be part of that?
Yeah. Oh, social media. I know it's a good tool, and it's a tool that I ought to use as a minister, but I don't even like going on Facebook anymore and seeing some of the things from friends, people who I'm close to on either side of the aisle,
yeah.
and some of the just terrible things that they say about each other. Right, they're not talking about policy anymore.
No, and somehow that medium makes it easier. I once had a nun friend in college who was so frustrated with the institution of the Catholic Church that she said she was practicing ecclesiastical fasting and not
okay.
going to church for a while. I feel that way about, I'm fasting from social media because it's not a healthy
yeah.
space.
I went on sabbatical in 2016. Oddly enough, it was the summer of 2016. And I took a break from anything but just the headlines of news for 12 weeks because it was just overwhelming for me. Now, mind you, I was kind of surprised when I got back from sabbatical in September 2016. And
there it was.
There it was. But it's a real thing. Why do you suppose people hide behind that?
Do you mean specifically
social media?
Social media,
yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, there's something easy about the anonymity, and there's something comforting about being in our own friendly ideological bubbles
mm-hmm.
that facilitates. I know when I've been in moments of political darkness, I have turned to those areas of social media that I know will back me up and
right.
and mirror my frustration back to me, which feels good.
Mm-hmm.
But that's short-lived. You know, it doesn't take you very far, I in my experience.
Right. How did this start? How is it that we came to this place?
Gosh. I think it's extremely complicated. You know, things happen culturally, things happen politically, things happen environmentally, but I think we can't underestimate the impact of our media fragmentation, where we don't all have a common news source anymore, so we don't even agree on the basic facts
right.
about which to argue, and it's really hard to engage the other when we don't have a shared common ground of truth.
Yeah. And there's so many outlets now. There's so many sources
right.
of news.
Right. And some, you know, we're now getting really scary information about how easy it is to outright fabricate mm-hmm. news and even video.
Yeah.
But even leaving that aside, the ideological narrowness and the almost complete blurring, even in media sites that I tend to like, blurring between editorial and news.
Right. So let's live in the solution rather than the problem, because nice. The problem is evident.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the solution, especially as it relates to religion and interfaith work, because that's something that we are both mm-hmm. passionate about. Mm-hmm. What do you think the role of religious communities, faith communities, are in trying to bring our polarized culture back together?
Well, unfortunately, many of the religious communities are just as polarized.
What? Really?
And frequently, it's political divisions around issues of race and gender and the various things that divide us have historically led to denominational splits.
Right.
So it's not that the faith communities have this down in any way.
Sure.
But there's something I think that's possibly useful in that faith communities are linked by a common set of stories, sometimes rituals, sometimes, you know, cultural artifacts, music, etc., mm-hmm. That can still bring people who deeply disagree into community with one another. So I think they point to the value of spaces where, almost where we're forced to be together. Mm. I often think of how great it is that Chico is still a small enough community that we can't totally escape each other into totally private enclaves. So I think that's a value sort of structurally that faith communities provide.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're talking about some strife that was within a lot of even denominations mm-hmm. now. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. just a Christian versus Muslim or Hindu.
That's actually quite uncommon. You know, I mean, we think of interreligious conflict when we think of, you know, Ireland and Catholics and Protestants, or the Middle East and Jews and Christians and Muslims. But really, I mean, I think the interfamily conflicts are often the most painful and the most deep, and those sort of geopolitical conflicts are, and I don't want to generalize, but are often driven by things wholly unrelated to to anything spiritual or faith-based.
Yeah. I really feel for my brothers and sisters in the United Methodists right now mm-hmm. who are struggling with just dealing with LGBTQI issues and how people that are gender and sexual minorities fit into the life of the church and mm-hmm. into the life of the leadership of the church mm-hmm. even.
But I do think we've learned from the interfaith movement, which is now well over 100 years old in this country, some strategies and principles that make that kind of engagement potentially fruitful. For instance, I think one lesson learned in the interfaith movement is that when people engage in dialogue with someone who is religiously different, there's often a fear of loss of faith, right?
Right.
But in fact, the reality is that never happens. In mm-hmm. my experience, that pretty much never happens. There's a quote from T.S. Eliot that I have loved since college that always comes back to me. He says in one of his poems, he says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive at where we started and know the place for the first time."
Mm, that's powerful.
Isn't that lovely? So
yes.
We go into this deep dialogue and immerse ourselves as much as we can in the worldview of another. We don't take on that worldview. We come home to our own and understand it more deeply, because it challenges us to ask questions about, why do I believe what I believe? What does my tradition teach about this topic? Mm-hmm. Are there aspects of that other tradition, maybe, you know, a prayer practice that can enrich my own faith? So I think that the traits that we learn in interfaith work are traits of openness and humility and vulnerability, because it is a risk.
Yes.
I remember being in a conversation with one young person a long time ago about she was an evangelical Christian, a fundamentalist Christian, and I was talking to her about some other religious ways of seeing, and she literally put her hands over her ears because it felt frightening to her. Right. Mm. So there's a bravery about entering into these other worldviews. But what if we could do that politically?
Mm.
What if we could have the courage to open our own worldview to the possibility of being informed by the other worldview? I used to say in talking about this that, you know, if we think of our polarization as a line, and we've got the far, far left at one end and the far, far right at the other, and the vast majority of us are somewhere in that middle space.
Yeah.
And I used to say, yeah, you're never going to get that weird uncle at the far other end, you know, to engage. But maybe you right. can turn to the person two ticks to the left or right of you and engage. But now I don't actually think it's a continuum like that. I think there are people who are deeply conservative politically, and mm-hmm. people who are deeply liberal, progressive, who are and are not open to engagement with the other. I don't think it's right. a matter of how far left or how far right you are. I think it's a more fundamental disposition than that. So if we are able to find those, I'm quite progressive in my political worldview. If I'm able to find a conservative who has a, regardless of, you know, how antithetical their political positions are, if they have that disposition of openness
yeah.
to see me as human and ask me good, hard questions, mm-hmm. that's the person I'm going to engage with.
Right. And if you're just joining us, this is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR, and this is our Faith and Common Ground segment. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And by Alternative Energy Systems, providing sustainable energy for life. Alternative Energy Systems offers solar, battery storage, and whole home generators solutions. More information at 345-6980 or visit SavingEnergyForLife.com. And I hope that you will all stay tuned for Playing Dead right after Peace and Social Justice.
Hi, this is Ray Lager, Underwriting Director at KZFR. In these uncertain times, one thing is for certain. You have to reach out to inform the public of any changes in your business or organization. If you'd like to be represented to our thousands of weekly listeners, please contact me at underwrite@kzfr.org or call or text me at 520-4742. That's 520-4742. I'd love to share some information about how KZFR can help you in these trying times. Please stay safe, and together we will grow a more compassionate community.
I know that one of the friends that I have is a conservative Christian. I consider myself a progressive Christian, and this person very much holds on to a conservative Christian worldview. And that relationship that we have at first was tenuous. We didn't know what to think of each other, but when we discovered that we were just human beings that shared some mm-hmm. of the same interests, we get to the point where we kind of joke with each other now. I always tell him, you know, you're not as conservative as you think you are. And he'll always say, well, you're not as liberal as you think you are. And we find ourselves being able to speak more openly about some of the mm-hmm. things just in the relationship mm-hmm. that we have. How do we help people to come together like that? How do we create avenues of dialogue?
Well, one of the things I'd want to say up front is that I don't think this is everybody's work.
Yeah.
I think there are people for whom engaging across those lines is not safe.
Mm.
I think people who are vulnerable by reason of their immigration status or racial ethnic identity, in racialized communities, I'm not going to ask those folks to engage across a difficult line of difference.
Right.
I feel like that's the work of people who have more privilege. So I think that's my job in a lot of ways, especially as an educator. So I think there are interpersonal strategies and then more structural strategies. I think what you've just suggested in relationship with your conservative friend is telling, that you start with the relationship.
Right.
Right. We don't go up to a stranger and have these, we can't productively engage with a stranger. So, but if we put ourselves in spaces, literally, you know, not isolate ourselves in the same geographical settings all the time, if we put ourselves in spaces where we can even meet one another, whether it's a community organization, whether it's a faith-based organization, we can begin to build those relationships. Then I think there are some dialogical strategies that that again we can draw on from the interfaith movement, where we practice real listening. That is not waiting for the pause in the conversation to begin to assert our own position again, but listen to understand. I always promote the value of authentic curiosity, and I'll sometimes put students through an exercise where those who feel deeply and differently about a given issue have to go through this kind of structured dialogue process where they tell a story that illustrates where that process, where that position came from. So not all the sort of enumerated reasons why I believe in stricter gun laws or whatever the issue is, but here's a story. Here's a thing that happened in my life. And then the other person tells a story that informs how they arrived at their position. Then we have to ask each other for more. We ask a curious question about that position. Then we begin to get into real human-to-human conversation. So those are some sort of techniques from what we've learned about, and not just in interfaith settings, but about dialogue, you know, from communications experts and therapists even, about what authentic listening looks like. But there are also, which I think is a very encouraging thing, there are also a lot of organizations emerging and growing that are creating structured opportunities for people in communities to do this. I think especially of an organization called Better Angels, which is a national organization that I think predated the 2016 election, but has certainly grown since. And they put on workshops. They call them red-blue workshops of various sorts, getting reds and blues to talk to each other, again, in a very structured way. And we brought Better Angels here and did one of these workshops in Chico a year or so ago. And one of the exercises they had us do that I thought was so interesting was each group team, you know, the red team and the blue team, had to separately identify, like we go to separate rooms and we list, what do we think are the negative stereotypes that the other side has about us? So the conservatives identified that they think they get stereotyped as racists.
Mm, right.
And the blues stereotyped that they think, concluded that they thought they got stereotyped as bleeding hearts, who weren't especially informed or practical in their position. So we go come up with these lists, and then we have to come back together and talk about what's the alternative. So we tell the other group, no, that's not true. We actually believe this. But then the hard part was each group had to identify what is the kernel of truth in that stereotype. What's the source of that? And that's that vulnerability, that humility. So you gotta build that carefully in these kind of structured encounters. But I think that's the key to it, is having the courage to be vulnerable, to say, yeah, you know, some of the positions that my party or my wing of the political spectrum takes, I got some questions about. I see some problems there. Then we can start to engage in a substantive way.
Right. And I see where that has happened in the interfaith movement. Tell me about the event that you had in the City Plaza, in 2017. What was that?
Yeah, this was This was a great event that just a group of community people, admittedly, we were progressives. This was a blue effort. But we, following that election, we were so horrified at what we had become as a country. Mm-hmm. And we knew we were better than this. So we wanted to do some public demonstration of that. So we just did a little fun event in the City Plaza on a Thursday night farmers market night.
Oh, right, yeah.
Where we organized people by just with poles that had signs at the top. And we had like 8 or 10 different groups, like hunters and fishermen over here, yoga lovers over here, farmers over here, educators over here, gamers had their own. So
gamers,
we had all these different kinds of identities about whom you might be tempted to have a stereotype,
sure,
right?
Yep.
Especially a red-blue kind of stereotype.
Yep.
And each of those groups had a basket of plastic balls of a certain color.
Mm-hmm.
And then up on the stage in the plaza, we had a giant mesh basket. And I asked a series of questions, and if you could respond from any of those groups, if you could respond yes to that question, you brought one of your colored balls up and put it in the basket, and you spent a minute introducing yourself to the people from those other groups who shared that identity. And these were lighthearted things mostly, like who loves to dance, mm-hmm. who has a tattoo. And so you would see these odd combinations of yoga lovers and hunters, you know, coming together and talking about just for a minute this thing they have in common. And in the process, we're filling up this giant mesh basket of all these multicolored balls,
right,
demonstrating that, yeah, we got a lot more in common than we might assume. And that was it. We played some music, we danced, and we went home.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was really fun.
I was a part of that. I can't remember whether I intentionally came down there for that or if I
just in the midst of the market, so a lot of people just stumbled by.
Yeah, but it was good because I remember what got me were gamers and farmers. That was the group that I ended up being in when I was playing with that. So, well, that's good because events like this in the community are certainly helpful. How about in our faith communities? How do you think we can teach, or at least the spiritual leaders can teach folks in their within their faith community to engage in these things, as far as the work of coming together and depolarizing goes?
Well, I always think food helps. I think
yes.
all of these events should revolve around food,
yep.
especially people contributing food for each other to share. But I think you've got to find people who want to do this. Nobody should be dragged to this work,
sure.
or shamed into this work. That's not useful. But I do think there's a hunger for it. Nobody likes the climate of our country right now. Nobody likes
right.
it. And as you say, it's local too. So I think, again, I like the idea of stories. So how can we come together, especially in a faith community, around a shared story? And if we can identify, it involves this courage of self-identifying. If I identify as a conservative, can I sit with my fellow congregant who identifies as a liberal or a progressive and tell how we relate to this shared story in a way that gets at those differences? I do this work in a classroom, so it's quite different. But I think the principles are basically the same. Lead people gently, make it a safe space, start with stories, not manifestos, and find that common ground without forcing agreement. Agreement is never the goal. It's just seeing each other as humans.
Right. And it goes beyond just the agree to disagree,
too. No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't even like that.
I don't either. I mean, of course we agree to disagree. That's the state
right.
of reality.
Yeah.
I think there's a desire for deeper engagement that we're tending to flee from out of fear, and that's too bad.
Yeah. So in an ideal world, as this unfolds and as we progress, project a little bit into the future and tell me what kind of, if these principles are embraced and we start living in this way, what's our world going to be like?
Wow. So much richer, so much more productive. You know, we're so stuck. Look at Washington. We're getting absolutely nothing done.
Right.
we can't get anything done in this state of just mutually assured destruction. You know, that's where we are. We're just in an arms race of hostility. I think at the Chico level, I want to get to know my neighbors better.
Yeah.
I want to, and who knows what these new district elections are going to do? This is going to be really interesting.
Yes.
Our council's going to change. Maybe it will be a fresh start for us. I kind of like to think that. I have visions of block parties and new emerging community organizations around shared interests that don't divide us politically. You know, it's interesting. You talk about the role of the faith communities. One thing that I worry about is that the faith communities are one of those spaces, as I was saying, that create the possibility for conversation across political lines.
Mm-hmm.
Most congregations are not growing, right?
Correct.
The fastest growing sector of the religious economy is non-religious people.
Yep. SBNR, spiritual but not religious.
Yes, or the NONES, the nuns.
Yep.
So what spaces will those people find that are not ideologically locked down? That's my concern. So I really think we do need a birth of new kinds of community organizations. Yeah. And fortunately, I'm old enough that I can hand this work to my children's generation because they give me a great deal of hope.
Absolutely. Well, Kate, thank you so much for being on the show today. I appreciate all the work that you do, and I appreciate the time you gave today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And this is Peace and Social Justice on KZFR 90.1, Chico listener-supported community radio. And here's the irony of that interview. That interview took place in February of 2020, and 18 days later, we were put on lockdown, and a lot of things changed. So I thought that was kind of a ironic interview to broadcast on this day as we are slowly emerging out of the pandemic. Hey, if you like this show and enjoy this program, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show. For my last interview, I get to interview the new executive director of Stonewall Alliance. One of my favorite organizations here in Chico is Stonewall Alliance, a local nonprofit agency who is committed to cultivating a safe, open, inclusive environment for all members of the LGBTQ plus and ally community. And I appreciate Stonewall's commitment to social justice, which is why representatives are often guests on this show, Peace and Social Justice. Stonewall is out there doing the work in big, bold, beautiful ways. And a few weeks ago, I started seeing posts here and there hinting that something exciting is happening at Stonewall Alliance. And I figured it might have something to do with Chico Pride this summer, or maybe it was about some services that are coming back online now that more folks are getting vaccinated and COVID restrictions are being lifted. But then I found out that this wasn't about something, but someone. So after a long, meticulous search process, Stonewall Alliance has called a new executive director, Andrea Mox. Congratulations, and welcome to Peace and Social Justice.
Hey, thank you, Jesse. Happy to be here.
So tell me about yourself and how you came to be at the helm of Stonewall Alliance.
Well, one wouldn't think that a techie nerd might end up being, you know, the executive director for Stonewall, but that's actually how I came about. So for 32 years, I was in higher ed IT. I spent 25 years at Chico State in higher ed IT management, and then spent the last 8 years at Butte College, ending up as their chief technology officer. So, you know, it's been an interesting career, but that career really centered around people who use technology. So I'm very much a people person. And probably about halfway through my career at Chico State, I finally had to become honest with myself. I had a husband and two small kids, and I had to come out of that closet because I was suffering, not living my true and authentic self. Mm. And it was a really interesting and difficult journey. And it was really Stonewall that helped me through that journey. So I remember with butterflies going into Stonewall for the first time as a queer person and actually saying, hey, I'm out, I'm a lesbian, and I need help. And they were there to embrace me and support me and support my family as well through the process. And so I've always had an affinity and a really warm spot in my heart for Stonewall. So when I decided to start thinking about retirement, I'm close friends with the board chair at Stonewall, and Connor was kind of poking at me to maybe come on over and check out being the new executive director. And so we talked at length about it for quite some time, and I finally said, I think it's time to have a meaningful career and really give back to the LGBT community. So that's how I ended up where I'm at.
That's amazing. I think that it's especially meaningful that you reached out to Stonewall and Stonewall was able to help you those many years ago. And here you are leading Stonewall.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty fascinating. That was not really ever anything I saw myself in that capacity. But really the last 8 years while I was at Butte College, I was heavily involved with LGBTQ issues on campus. Mm. And I became the GSA faculty staff advisor for the GSA club. So I got to mentor young LGBTQ students, and then we got to push some advocacy on campus, and I was involved with a new committee that started called the Gender and Sexuality and Equity Task Force, and we started doing some really great things that made life, especially for our transgender students, just ever so slightly a touch easier. Mm-hmm. By implementing system changes and being able to implement business process changes and to train faculty and staff about LGBTQ issues. So woven throughout my career, I've stayed close to students and trying to support students in use of technology and leveraging technology to make student life a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. I'm very thankful that you are committed to education as well. That's so important to educate, especially our faculty, not just our students, about LGBTQ issues.
Yeah, it's a challenging time. I think, you know, folks are aware of things called pronouns that are other than just he and she.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? And there needs to be so much education wrapped around that, because a lot of people just don't either understand it or they don't care to try to understand it. And they don't understand the implications and sometimes the devastating implications to their students when they misgender them or use the wrong pronouns and they don't honor those pronouns. So a lot of work to be done still.
Yes. I very much appreciate when I see staff and faculty in the directories using the preferred pronouns as well.
Yes.
in their biographical information. That's great.
And, yeah.
And you see it on Zoom conferences too. You'll see somebody's name and the preferred pronouns after it. So that's great that you've been a part of that education.
Yes, it's been really an exciting journey to watch as things, you know, as we make progress there. But there is still so much work to do, of course.
For sure. So speaking of which, what are some of the biggest challenges that you see in our community that Stonewall Alliance can address?
Well, I think our community is so divided, and I think we see this across the country most definitely. We have the Chico area is interesting because, you know, close to campus and the areas surrounding campus tend to be a little bit more liberal and accepting. And then, you know, you step just a short ways out of that and it's maybe a little bit more rural and a little bit more, say, traditional values. And folks tend to have some real challenges with LGBTQ community. And I think that's been definitely exacerbated over the past 4 years. And we've seen a bigger divide and less support and definitely more hateful rhetoric and bullying towards the LGBT community because it's just been it's been allowed to happen. It's been accepted.
Yeah.
So while we do see, you know, it's called the rainbow wave, we have seen more positions of influence, especially political positions, where we have actual, you know, known and out trans and LGBTQ candidates and positions now. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done to kind of bring cohesion and support to the community. And I think we start from within. Mm-hmm. It's been a really difficult road, and, you know, adding COVID to everything has made it harder. And so right now, the need for connection within our community is really critical. We recently had a Trans Month celebration, and we ended that month with a parking lot event where everybody was masked and socially distanced, but we had a DJ and we had, you know, all sorts of artisan booths. We had, you know, a coffee truck there. It was really great. And everybody that came to that event was so excited just to see each other in a face-to-face, you know, context. And I think we're craving that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's great to have events like that. I recently, our church has started meeting in very limited ways inside and having indoor services as well as online services, simulcasting. How about your programs, though? How has COVID-19 affected your mission in the community, and how do you see the organization helping folks re-enter or enter into a post-COVID world?
Yeah, COVID has presented real challenges. You know, Butte County, it's tough sometimes for our clients to actually have the technology they need or the internet connection they need to come to any kind of remote sessions that we have for our youth or you know, for other advocacy or training sessions that we offer. We've seen a real downturn in the ability for people to actually attend those sessions. And that's been of great concern because during COVID, when's the time that people need the most care and maybe mental health support services, some of the things that we provide at Stonewall, is during a pandemic. I mean, it's at crisis level. And so we've been trying to do as much outreach as we can, but we also have to do that safely. I'm definitely excited. We've started talking a little bit about what is our transition back into, you know, a face-to-face world going to look like. And so with our Pride coming up here in June, that's going to be the whole month of June. We're going to have all sorts of great activities, and we're looking at actually having a couple of in-person safe events so that we can again start establishing that connection with the community. I think the other thing we're going to do is we're going to start opening up and doing in-person trainings again as it feels safe to do that for the variety of you know, areas that we do that training for. And then also really looking forward to getting our youth groups back together and in a safe face-to-face space. I think one of the things we're going to do, of course, because I'm a nerd, we're going to leverage technology because not everybody will feel comfortable or safe attending those events face-to-face. So I'm looking at how we can create some kind of a hybrid model to create community space in face-to-face realm, but then also invite people in, you know, via Zoom or some other technology so that we can really not just flip the switch, because I think that's going to be too harsh. Mm-hmm. We really need to have some medium.
Yeah.
So
that's great that you're thinking along those lines. And like you say, it's not just like flipping a switch. There's got to be a transition in there. Because I hope we don't go back to the way things were or the old normal, right?
Right.
I hope that the new normal that we live into is going to be better. I hope that we've learned some lessons during this time. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Peace and Social Justice here on KZFR. And Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the regional and continuing education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in a wide variety of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, the LSAT, and rce.csuchico.edu. And by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned and operated and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. And if you're just joining us, this is Peace and Social Justice. I'm your third Friday host, Jesse Kearns, and I am on the phone with the new executive director at Stonewall Alliance, Andrea Marks. Excuse me, Marks. Mocks. Sorry about that. For some reason, I have Marks on my mind. I don't know why. So, what are some services that you've provided in the past that are coming back online, meaning coming back into that they're going on now? And are there any new services that you are offering?
Yeah, so we've been continuing to offer some of our advocacy appointments, which are one-on-one appointments in person. Those are appointments where we're maybe helping a trans individual maybe pick out a binder to a chest binder because they are possibly thinking about different, trying on some different gender fluidity, looks. And so those are very personal and private. You know, we can't really do that over Zoom. And so we've continued to safely do that with masking and things like that. So we can provide some individual care and assistance. We still provide in-person HIV testing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we've some of those very intimate, services that we provide, we've continued to do. Where we've really had to throttle back a bit is in our outreach and our training. It's just hard right now to get big groups of folks trained, especially when they're all also online and trying to navigate a pandemic.
So
our training coordinator has done a really good job, but we're looking forward to really bolstering and getting back into some face-to-face training. One thing that they've been working on, that's Marin, they've been working to kind of redevelop some of our curriculum and start creating a series-level training rather than just one training that everybody goes to and then maybe a year later we do another training. Really looking to be delivering some more engaged methods to train on LGBTQ issues and tailoring it to the group that we're working with. So if they're care providers, then we have a whole way to work with care providers and talk about you know, how do you honor somebody's pronouns, and how do you talk about LGBTQ bodies differently than you would talk about maybe, you know, somebody who is non-LGBTQ and non, you know, more of a cisgendered person that you know, the medical profession is used to doing. And then trying to tailor as well to, you know, K through 12 education. How can we train, you know, teachers in K-12 to deal with and learn about and respect and honor LGBTQ students? So really looking forward to continuing to build those programs and add to them. We did our very first video session training that we're going to be finishing up, and we'll be able to deliver to schools. And it's about, you know, wraps around with suicide prevention and when you're an LGBTQ student, what that might look like for you and how can you get assistance, because there's, you know, some nuances and extra difficulty if you're LGBTQ and trying to reach out for help sometimes. So, you know, those are exciting programs. And, of course, coming back into Pride and trying to do what we can to cultivate face-to-face events again, really, really important. Some of the other work, though, that we're really starting to focus on is some of our, you know, advocacy work. We're working with some key folks in the community to help develop some equity training that will be able to be delivered by some area experts, and focusing really on equity in our LGBTQ populations of color, and how do we provide support for our, you know, populations of color and communities of color. It's difficult because those populations are already taxed. Mm-hmm. Well beyond. And so we want to be very careful about how we approach that and not further tax the you know, populations that we have, because we don't have a lot of populations of, you know, we don't have numbers of color, LGBTQ, you know, communities of color. We don't have a lot of people in those areas. So we want to make sure we're not taxing folks even more. Mm-hmm. Because they already carry a lot. So looking to partner with folks who do have the expertise that they can give, and that we're compensating them for their work to do that, and then providing you know, more services to those communities. That's an area of great emphasis for us. You know, Stonewall recognizes that most of us are cisgender and white in our organization, and we're trying to find ways to be more inclusive. So I think that's a big focus for us as we come into the year here.
Yeah. One of the things that I've appreciated, well, several things I appreciate about Stonewall Alliance in the 13 years that I've been here, is how much emphasis there is on building community. I know that I am in charge of clergy ethics and boundaries for the Northern California and Nevada denomination, my denomination, and I was looking at some of the materials that covered LGBTQ issues, and I thought this is just not enough, and I just called Connor and Alyssa. They gave me a huge packet of wonderful things to draw from, and it helps so much. I know that you provide things like that for so many people here in this community. There aren't many people, I don't think. Of course, I run in different circles maybe, but I don't know too many people that when you say Stonewall Alliance, they don't know what we're talking about, you know? So from my perspective, yeah. Stonewall is not an island unto itself, but has made great efforts to be known in the community by establishing partnerships with other organizations. So my question then is, what sort of help do you need, and how can people help you? How can they get involved?
Well, you know, I hate to sound trite here, but nonprofits are hurting financially for sure. And the grants that we get from the various groups that we work with, they've also experienced budget cuts. So, you know, we're working pretty hard to try to maintain our financial solvency. So certainly if folks would like to donate some dollars, that's always a great thing. We can use it and we put it, turn it right around and put it to, you know, the services that we provide. That's pretty obvious there. I think the other thing that we really could use are sponsors and other volunteers to help us with some of the events that we're putting on, and then also getting involved and giving us, you know, some of that feedback that we need. Investing in Stonewall with a little bit of time can go a long way to help us be more progressive and move forward. So, again, connecting not just with the LGBTQ population, but with the general population, especially our allies out there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think looking for volunteers to participate within the organization is something that we really need a little bit more of. I've been working with some other leaders across the United States, executive directors in my little boot camp that I'm in. And, you know, the majority of the entities are experiencing a crisis in people who just, we need volunteers, right, to invest in their centers. And so it's kind of an endemic issue. It's not just a Chico issue, but we're all hurting for participation. And, you know, the more participation that we have with a wider group of individuals, then the stronger we become, right?
Right.
So I think that's another area that we really need assistance with. And then I think the other part that I'm really looking out is reaching out more into the community and creating some strong relationships with businesses who can help us push forward as well, whether it's sponsorship in our events or whether it is to participate and become an ongoing donor, or are we able to partner with them in some other way where we can have some mutual benefit there. Those are some of the things I'm looking at. Obviously, with my connections with Butte College, I've been able to very quickly cement some additional support for Butte College students who are in the LGBTQ community. And as they are needing resources, then we can either direct them to specific folks at Butte College now or vice versa. So we've established a really nice partnership that way. So just trying to find ways to support our LGBTQ community and use some different methodologies maybe than have been done in the past.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I am looking forward to Pride being a big event where people can gather together without social distance and online. Not that the online is bad, but there's just something about gathering down at the plaza with so many people. But I have been very impressed over the past couple of years that you've been able to have Pride live, is how many families have been showing up and how many children are there and how many things for them to do, and just the joy that is in the place where Pride is held on Saturday, where Pride is held down on the downtown area. So I wish you the best. But
thank you.
One of the questions I always ask guests here on Peace and Social Justice, at least on the Fridays that I do it, is what word of hope can you offer our listeners who may be feeling a little hopeless and helpless after living through what seems like crisis after crisis over the last 4 or 5 years?
Oh, just one word, huh?
No, not necessarily one word, but a word, a testimony of...
Yes.
Yeah.
I have a sign in my office at Stonewall now, and it says, love is love. Mm. And so I think that really speaks to the whole idea of community.